Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope on Thomas. At his Wednesday general audience, Pope Benedict looks at the figure of St. Thomas Aquinas, the 13th century Italian philosopher and theologian and doctor of the church. Tarred and oily. As oil and tar balls wash ashore along the US's Gulf Coast, we find out how the continuing oil spill is impacting upon the lives of the local communities and how they feel about the handling of this environmental crisis. Myanmar Memories. Irish priest and renowned environmentalist Sean McDonough, who has just returned from a visit to Myanmar or Burma, talks about the plight of its people and the environmental damage caused by massive deforestation. And Nobel Wisdom. With the ongoing global economic crisis sparking debate about the need for more ethics in the world's financial system, we talk to a Nobel laureate, who is known as the Mother Teresa of Economics, for his studies on famine and welfare economics. At his Wednesday general audience, Pope Benedict spoke about one of the church's outstanding figures, the 13th century Italian philosopher and theologian, St. Thomas Aquinas. Charles Collins reports.
Pope Benedict continued his series of talks on the Christian culture of the Middle Ages with the important figure of St. Thomas Aquinas, the Dominican theologian who is the patron saint of Catholic schools and universities. The Pope spoke about how St. Thomas reacted to the philosophical revolution caused in the Middle Ages by the renewed interest in the thought of the classical Greek philosopher Aristotle. Most theologians of the time used Plato as their philosophical model and were suspicious of using Aristotle because he had not been used by the Church Fathers.
Thomas' insistence on the harmony of faith and reason respected the autonomy and complementarity of those two ways of knowing the truth, which has its ultimate origin in God's word. Faith sheds fuller light on the truths which reason is naturally capable of knowing, while drawing from revelation a supernatural knowledge of the divine mysteries and the triune God himself. Reason, for its part, serves to demonstrate faith's credibility, to defend its teaching, and to show its inner consistency and intelligibility. The complementary relationship between faith and reason reflects the truth that God's grace builds on, elevates, and perfects human nature, which is thus enabled to pursue the felicity which is its deepest desire.
Although some during the period thought Greek philosophy was troublesome because it was without Christian revelation, Pope Benedict said Thomas showed that human reason is capable of grasping some truths without revelation.
Thomas's conviction that we are naturally able to acknowledge the principles of the natural moral law remains timely, since that law, grounded in the truth of man's nature, is the basis of respect for human dignity and universal human rights.
In this World Cup season, the Pope also sent greetings to the participants of the International Vincenzo Romano Memorial Soccer Tournament. He hoped they would help spread the universal message of solidarity and brotherhood. I'm Charles Collins.
It's the worst environmental disaster America has ever faced, and for President Obama, it's arguably the biggest challenge facing his presidency. In the nearly 2 months since an explosion at a drilling well off the Gulf Coast of the USA, the oil company BP and government scientists have failed at nearly every effort to plug the leak of gushing oil. But as the fallout from the oil spill continues to reverberate in the political arena on a daily basis, what are the feelings of those people in the Gulf areas who are now having to experience at first hand the oil and tar balls washing up on their beaches? How badly has it impacted upon the livelihoods of people in the local fishing and tourism industries? And what do they think about the way the disaster has been handled and about the spill's long-term effects on the area's environment? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Monsignor Michael Farmer, Vicar General of the Catholic Archdiocese of Mobile in Alabama. That's one of the areas along the Gulf Coast where tar balls and oil from the spill are washing up on the local beaches. He began by telling me how the spill has been impacting upon the local community.
Along our Gulf Coast, which are primarily two counties in our archdiocese, have both been affected, particularly one of our small fishing villages, Bayou La Batterie, and our recreational cities of Orange Beach, Alabama, Dolphin Island, Alabama, and Gulf Shores, Alabama.
And as these tar balls wash ashore, what are the people's feelings there in those coastal areas? Can you tell us something about their mood?
I think the mood of most people, it is disappointment. Of course, many who have their livelihood from the Gulf of Mexico, be it fishing, recreational fishing, or tourism, running hotels and condominiums, are now at a point of not only disappointment, but frustration and anger about the bureaucracy of BP and our federal government. Some of the bureaucracy of trying to get people in to clean up the beaches, skim the water. So I think that's the feeling.
So generally, people aren't very satisfied with the handling so far of this crisis. They feel, as you say, there was too much bureaucracy and too much time wasted.
Yes, I think that's the feeling, and I think there's, to a certain degree, too, growing apprehension of just what are really the facts of this oil leak. You know, the whole debate about how many gallons and barrels of oil are leaking a day seems to change constantly. And so I think what people really would like is just a clearer picture of this. Though at the same time, I think people understand it's a frustrating situation for everybody involved, both the local communities, our local government, the oil industry itself, and our government.
Have you been to the beach, to the coastal areas? Have you seen for yourself the impact of this spill? Can you describe for us a little bit what it looks like, how it has affected the beaches?
Along our Gulf Coast here in the Archdiocese of Mobile, the beaches are Mobile County and Baldwin County, Alabama, and I have been to the beaches over in Baldwin County, which is primarily our recreational and tourist area. It's white sand, very clear, beautiful white sand that now has been inundated with tar balls and also just actual clunks, if you will, of oil that have come up onto the beach. And it's because of the sugar white beach being the way it is, it shows itself even more and looks somewhat more devastating. You know, the pristine beach now is dirty. It takes about 2 days, 2.5 days to clear it off each time they have this wash up on shore. So you see that there are not as many tourists there. There are still tourists coming, but due to this fact, people are staying away from our coastal towns, particularly our more recreational towns, for the summer. This is the height of the tourist season right now, and a lot of those people are not coming, and it's devastating to look at, but it's also sad to see the crowds of the people not on the beaches and the restaurants and things not as filled as they otherwise would be.
And how big are these tar balls?
The ones that as close as you can get up to are, some look almost like small rocks, and some are a little larger than that. And with summer heat, of course, the tar balls are, they come ashore, and then on the warm sand, they begin to, it's almost like a melting thing, which makes it even more difficult, I think, for the cleanup crews to get them all cleaned up, because it more meshes into the sand once it comes on shore.
Is it the case that many people are playing down the impact because they're worried that it will drive tourists away? I'm talking obviously about people who are involved in the tourist industry.
Yeah, well, I think they're not necessarily, I don't believe they're necessarily playing it down, but I think what we're finding is with this prolonged oil leak in the Gulf itself and how long it takes to reach shore, that some beach, a town, let's say in our own archdiocese, we have two primarily coastal cities that are tourist centers, which are basically like 2.5 miles, 3 miles apart from each other. And it's just according to how these oil slicks come in. One beach could be hit one day, and 2 days later it's cleaned up. The other beach might not have any impact. So I think it is sort of calling people to at least come and still come to the beaches. I think they're being realistic about you can possibly get in the water some days and possibly some days not. So, I mean, yes, I think from a standpoint, economic standpoint, there's still this great invitation to come on down to the Gulf Coast and go to the condos and the hotels and to the restaurants, because it is the way this oil slick is working. One beach might have a problem and the other may not.
What has the Catholic Church, both locally and nationally, been saying about this continuing oil spill crisis?
For us as a local church, I don't know about the national church really, of our National Conference of Catholic Bishops, but the local church, that is the Archdiocese of Mobile, the Diocese of Biloxi, which is our neighboring diocese in Mississippi, and the Diocese of Pensacola-Tallahassee, which is to the east of us in the Florida Panhandle, I think all of us, as far as in our parishes and on weekdays as well as our Sunday masses, putting into the intercession basically a steadfast prayer and petition to God that those that are trying to resolve the oil leak, that they will be successful. And I think also, too, we have been praying for a renewed appreciation of God's creation and our good stewardship of His creation. And also from our ministry of our people here along the Gulf Coast, particularly in the Archdiocese of Mobile, I know our local Catholic social services, our local Catholic charities, is monitoring the needs of our own people, particularly in the fishing villages and also our tourist areas, that people, their livelihood, their economic livelihood is being damaged by this. Our social ministries are monitoring that now. We have not been inundated with requests yet, but as this awful situation continues, we know that our social ministries and outreach will probably be needed with our local people, both those working in tourism and the fishing industry.
Do people there fear that the effects of this spill may go on or may be felt for years to come? Is there a real fear about that?
I think there is a fear of the lasting impact. You know, I think there's at least a bit of degree of confidence with possibly the late summer bringing the actual oil leak to an end. But what is fearful now is the ecological impact and the economic impact that will come even after, God willing, and we pray that the oil leak is stopped. They're telling us if it's stopped, that it still has a 6-week period into which the oil comes on ashore. How much damage that does, particularly for the fishing industry, which along the Gulf Coast was already critically damaged with Hurricane Katrina and was just now getting back on their feet, if you will. Now this oil leak closes off the fishing waters, and once again their livelihood is damaged, and just how long they can bear that is really being discussed along the entire Gulf Coast, particularly in the fishing industry, about just how much more can they take, how many more months can they survive with limited fishing waters and the damage that it's causing. I think the discussion now is just what is the long-term impact with the ecology of the Gulf of Mexico. You know, will our fishing beds and places where oysters and shrimp are harvested, how long-term is that damage in those areas?
What do you think are the lessons that should be learned from this crisis? I mean, we've seen how, despite all our technological inventions, that they have really struggled to cap this oil. You know, they've been trying all sorts of things. It really has shown up the limits, hasn't it?
Yes, I think from a faith perspective, this is something that is a lesson that we're learning from modern humanity, that we have technology that can drill for oil 1 mile below the surface of the water and then another mile into the bed of the floor of the Gulf of Mexico. But that same technology, we don't have the technology to reverse that oil flow if it happens. And that is the frustrating thing here, that we are learning that technology also has its limitations. And I think not to be against technology, because we're praying that technology will be able to bring the oil leak to an end. But at the same time, it does question about, do we have technology that goes beyond our ability to control? And I think this is where the voice of the gospel, the voice of the church, has something to say about being careful of, quote, what you create when you cannot control it. And we're seeing that disastrously being lived out right now along the Gulf Coast. This trying all sorts of methods to bring this oil leak to an end. We had the technology to do all this drilling, but that very same technology we don't seem to have to stop the oil leak. And to remember that there is an ultimate creator, and also just a renewed understanding, too, of our dependency, I guess, too, on fossil fuels.
Are people starting to question our dependency on fossil fuels, our over-dependency, given, as you say, these very high-risk operations like deep-sea oil drilling?
Yes, I think that's going to be part of the debate. There will always be the two extremes, I'm sure, out there in that debate. But I think most people are realizing, is this what it's going to take? And, quote, is this technology going to continue to do this just to be able to feed our dependency upon fossil fuels? So are we willing to, the modern culture and society, are we willing to be sacrificial, that is? Are we willing to not just drain our natural resources but try to preserve them so that we don't have to go to such extremities for the fossil fuels? In other words, can we also then use the very technology that's drilling a mile underneath the seabed? Can we also use that mind power, that creative energy and wisdom that God gives a human being, to maybe figure out other ways that are not so destructive or potentially destructive for energy usage?
I was speaking to Monsignor Michael Farmer, Vicar General of the Archdiocese of Mobile in Alabama. Once one of Asia's richest countries, Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, has been ruled by a ruthless military dictatorship for almost 50 years and is now one of the continent's poorest nations. The generals and the army in Myanmar suppress almost all dissent and have been accused of gross human rights violations, including the widespread use of forced labour, often involving children. The ruling junta has scheduled multi-party elections for some time in 2010. However, the planned poll has been widely dismissed by critics and opposition figures as a sham to create a facade of civilian rule and democracy. Irish priest Father Sean McDonough is a well-known environmental campaigner and author who's just returned from a two-month tour of Asia that included a visit to Myanmar. He spoke to me about his impressions.
Well, I travelled, I travelled into Rangoon and then up to the tribal areas of the Kachin and the Shan. There would be tribal peoples on the north of Mandalay. Well, of course, Burma has been in the grip of a brutal dictatorship since 1962 when the General Ne Win took over. And it's a tragic country because in the 19th century it was one of the richest countries in Asia. One of the reasons for building the Suez Canal was to bring Burma rice to Europe. And here it is now, hardly able to feed itself. You've had huge social pressures, of course. People don't trust each other. There's a complete breakdown in trust. The army has structured everything so that it can control, even the universities, for example. You won't get the various faculties in a campus together because in the thinking of the army, they're warp thinking that there would be too much possibilities for people coming together, maybe planned sedition as they see it. So everything is divided. Everyone is set against everyone else. There's huge corruption, of course, and that's also very evident, and people are very upset about that kind of thing. I'm also looking at, of course, the impoverishment level and the environmental destruction. I mean, Burma was a very rich country environmentally, biodiversity-wise, one of the most richest countries in Asia. In the last 10 or 15 years, you've seen its teak forests has been just torn apart and shipped over the border into China. The same is true of its jade. And now there are real problems up around the border area on some of the rivers. Some of the tributaries of the Irrawaddy, that the Chinese want to build huge power stations, not to bring power to Burma, but to bring the power back over the Chinese border. And, of course, it's one of the reasons why the Burmese military are not in any way responsive to the negative critique of outside countries, because they know they have the support of the Chinese. And basically, that's why they continue. For example, they're supposedly running an election in the autumn, a general election. But they made sure that the party of Aung San Suu Kyi, that people have a way, the human spirit is quite resilient. So they were talking about the general election, you see, and if within a day or two, the people were saying, no, the general's election.
One of the aspects of Burma, I read recently that Burma has the highest number of child soldiers in the world and that this number is growing. Did you see very clear evidence of how children were being used as labourers in all sorts of ways?
Oh, yes, I did, yeah. But not so much as the child soldiers, but yes, children are being used and being used in many of the areas in which I went. It was very obviously very clear, yeah. And people are very critical of that, but people are not directly critical of the military because they're very fearful. They realize what happened to the Buddhist monks uprising in 2007. It was just brutally put down and very violently put down. And people whom I know, for example, some of my own colleagues who would have worked in Latin America during dictatorships like Pinochet, comparing it to the dictatorship in Burma, they would say the dictatorship of Pinochet was mild. The kind of ruthlessness that is at the heart of what's happening in Burma, and it's very tragic.
You say that people are very frightened. Is that because that everybody is spying on everybody else? Did they sort of talk at all about this? Did they talk at all about the opposition, or were they simply too frightened to do that with you?
Well, it depends where you are, and like in some of the areas, for reason, even in the Catholic community, they were not able to put me up in the local parish or the local bishop's house. It depended what kind of relationship with the local military there. And so in some situations, you had to stay in a hotel. But everyone is concerned about other people in the group that would be spying for the military, yes. And the military very much in control. And, of course, coming up to the election now, the control levels will increase. There will be pretending in some ways to make available like more food, etc., to get obviously a favourable result. But the controls will increase. Maybe again after the election, they'll minimise a certain amount.
So coming back to Burma and the deforestation,
yes.
I mean, you said that China was the country mainly buying this timber. But are there Western countries also that are dealing with Burma or, you know, despite the sanctions?
Well, not that I saw very much. I saw the Chinese presence very, very strong on both sides. Like they were moving a lot of natural resources from Myanmar, Burma into China. And one of the big changes that had taken place in the last, say, 6 years, according to my informants, was Burma was basically a bicycle country and Rangoon was a bicycle country. But now in exchange for the money that's made exporting its natural resources, a flotilla of motorcycles are coming in to almost all the cities. And, of course, people are not used to the rules of the road, so they're causing havoc. So that's another example, I suppose, of a country that is now beginning to see some ways of development by going down the petrochemical avenue, and that's probably not great either.
Is there any particularly memorable anecdote that you can share with us from your trip that somehow exemplifies or sums up the plight of the Burmese people, its environmental devastation, the lack of democracy there, whatever?
Well, I suppose no, but I was brought to places by both bishops and priests and sisters there. And I suppose the one place that I was very poignantly affected by, because a Colombian priest set up a catechetical center not too far from Michina back in the 1940s, and Now this whole area is going to be inundated by a whole structure of dams to actually build this hydroelectric scheme. And so I could still see the house and the catechetical centre that this person had, and I won't name the person who was with me, but just to think of all that work, the people who worked around there, and suddenly it's going to be completely wiped out. And the worst thing about it is the people who are going to build the dam are not even Burmese themselves. They're going to actually bring Chinese workers across the border, build a dam, and then use the water, obviously, behind the dam for energy in China.
I was speaking to Father Sean McDonough about his recent trip to Myanmar or Burma. The ongoing global economic crisis has sparked much debate about the need for more ethics and solidarity in the world's financial system. Among those who made such an appeal was Pope Benedict in his encyclical Caritas in Veritate, released in 2009. In his encyclical, the Pope says every economic decision has a moral consequence, and that's why economics must have the common good as its ultimate goal, rather than simply profits. Charity, he wrote, demands justice, and this must be applied to every phase of economic activity, because justice is always concerned with man and his needs. The question of justice, especially when applied to economics, has long been the concern of the prominent Indian economist and writer Amartya Kumar Sen, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1998. Sen has been dubbed the Mother Teresa of economics for his studies on famine, human development theory, welfare economics, and the underlying mechanisms of poverty. He's recently published a major philosophical work entitled The Idea of Justice, and he began by speaking to us about the message he is trying to get across in his latest book.
But my idea of justice is to use reasoning that human beings are capable of using in order to identify basic injustices on which agreement could be reached, that they are, one, unjust, and two, removable, and therefore remediable injustice. My idea of justice is not concerned so much with speculating about what a perfectly just society would look like. So if you want me to put it in a nutshell, that's the way I would present the basic idea of justice that I'm trying to pursue and analyze in this book.
Pope Benedict spoke of the importance of promoting equality and human development, and not just pursuing the interests of markets, in his Caritas in Veritate encyclical. So, does Sen see an affinity there between the Pope's views on economic issues and his own views?
I do, in that respect, certainly. And in other respects, too, I was privileged to be in an advisory committee when the Centesimus Annus was being produced on the centenary of the Rerum Novarum. I did go to Vatican a number of times at that time and had the privilege of talking with the Pope. And indeed, I'm very privileged to have lunch with him a couple of occasions. He was a very good and kind host. And I think the encyclical that came reflects some of the things that we are discussing. One doesn't have to be religious or share the same religion in order to agree on propositions of a kind that seemed to me to be very insightful and very powerful. And I'm delighted that these things have come from many different quarters with distinct religions and among people who are not religious as well as people who are deeply religious. So I think there could be much greater agreement on that. And that is quite important, since in my book, in The Idea of Justice, which was published recently, I just try to discuss why public agreement on the basis of reasoning, transcending our special sectional belief, is very important in the pursuit of justice.
That was Amartya Sen, Nobel Laureate for Economics. Well, that's that's all for now from me, Susie Hodges. We hope you've enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow, and you can listen to us at any time by going to our website at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.